From Alice in Wonderland. "How do you know I'm mad?" said Alice. "You must be," said the cat, "or you wouldn't have come here." Lola Adams received two regular visits after she was jailed for the murder of her husband, Kyle. One was Temple Representative Michael Learn. The other was her mother, Lucille Bibb, whom she hadn't seen since joining the Temple 6 years prior. Lucille was the person who contacted defense attorney Sage Watkins. She was also a constant support to Lola in the days and weeks following her arrest. In Florida, all jailhouse visits are recorded. The state's liberal press laws frequently allow media outlets to obtain these videos, as happened in this case. Jailhouse video, Lola Adams and Lucille Bibb.
"What did you eat yesterday?"
"There was potato and ham, I think. And canned green beans, I think they were."
"Oh, like the kind I put in casserole?"
"Yeah."
"That's good. Sweetheart, I saw Kyle had his memorial service yesterday. It was in Philadelphia, not here."
"Oh."
"I thought about sending flowers, but under the... Well, I didn't send anything."
"Yeah."
"There was a lovely piece about him in the paper. I cut it out for you. Can you read that?"
I don't want to read it, Mom. Mom, why are you showing this to me?"
I thought you'd want to see. You have to mourn, sweetheart. You're mourning, too."
"I can't mourn. I did this."
"You didn't do this. They did this."
"I don't know."
"I know, baby. I wish to God I could go back and stop this from happening."
The first time a new recruit attends an event is critical. These frequently take the form of a workshop, a retreat, or a course, usually out of town and allowing no contact with friends or family.
Why is this a critical stage?
Because it marks the first step in establishing the cult identity.
Would you expand on that?
The most important thing to understand about anyone in a cult is that they have two identities. There is their real identity, their authentic self, the person they were before entering the cult, or if they've been raised in a cult, it's the person they really are underneath. The other identity is the cult identity, the person controlled by the group's leader, the person that believes the doctrine, no matter how nonsensical, and accepts the abuse unleashed upon them. It's the cult identity that sacrifices their money, time, friends, family, all of it. The cult works to create this new identity.
How?
Kurt Lewin's three-step model of change theory explains it like this. Imagine you have a cube of ice, but you want a conical shape of ice. The first thing you have to do is unfreeze the cube. Then you reshape the water into the shape you want, in this case a cone. Then you refreeze the water until you have what you want. Unfreeze, change, refreeze. In human terms, you have to tear down a person's old identity, create a new identity, and then reinforce that identity. Unfreeze, change, refreeze.
Okay. What does this model have to do with a recruit's first cult event?
That's the cult's chance to unfreeze. They typically begin by removing a person from everything familiar. No contact with the outside world, no going back to their home, no time left alone.
Why?
The goal is to make the recruit believe what they otherwise wouldn't. You achieve this with the right combination of factors. Firstly, you actually compromise their cognitive ability. When a person is presented with difficult, confusing, or nonsensical information, a lot of things new recruits are taught are contradictory or puzzling. The person becomes overstimulated and overwhelmed. And when this happens, cognitive function measurably slows down. It's the brain's defense mechanism. Second, remove every frame of reference a person has. People, things, places, and they become displaced. A person can't ground themselves or discuss what they're hearing with anyone else. There's no bouncing ideas off of anyone. They're not even allowed to think by themselves. New recruits are given no time alone, no time to reflect. They're kept busy for the entire duration of the event. Removing the recruit's frame of reference means they are more likely to go along with whatever they're hearing. Thirdly, new recruits are surrounded with people readily, eagerly, believing what they're told. It's a person's natural instinct to socially conform, to take our cues from someone or something else when we're confused. To recap, a new recruit is isolated. Their cognitive ability is compromised. They're stripped of all frames of reference, and they're exposed to nothing but belief and acceptance.
And this unfreezes their current identity?
It's what makes them vulnerable to the unfreezing process. In order for a person to be unfrozen, they need to have their identity torn down. This happens by coming to believe they are flawed. They have problems they're incapable of fixing. They will come to view their past selves, those with problems, as evil and/or pathetic. It's like mental boot camp.
Is everyone at these events involved in the conspiracy of doing this to new recruits?
It's no conspiracy. They're all believers. They may be taking steps to manipulate new recruits, but they see what they're doing as righteous.
We arrived in Key Largo Sunday evening. It was overcast, but very beautiful. We drove to this house by the water, which had been rented for the retreat. A sand pathway led down to the ocean, and there were yoga mats lined up in a row, like sardines. I remember watching the sand blow over them.
How many people were in the house?
30, 40. We were the last to arrive.
What did you do when you got there?
Well, as soon as we got in the door, we put our phones into this big wooden box. It was a no-phone retreat, which I'd been told in advance.
Did you have any other mode of communication on you?
No. I just had some clothes and toiletries, not even makeup.
Okay. What happened next?
We were shown to our rooms. The men were separated from the woman, and we were crammed into a total of 4 bedrooms, 2 to a bed. I bunked with a woman named Sherry, who had been to several of these retreats. She was really excited. It was my first time.
What did you do that first night?
We all had dinner, buffet style, sitting on the ground and milling around. And then we all congregated on the patio and did exercises and meditations until the middle of the night.
When was the first time you saw Ty Byman?
It was at dinner. We were sitting around eating, and then Ty came down the stairs in gray slacks and a button-down black silk shirt. It was a big contrast to his white hair. He seemed stately and at ease.
Did you speak with him?
No, not then.
Did he address the group?
Yes, he welcomed us, and he told us how important the work was that we were about to do, and that we were going to leave in a better state, and if we applied ourselves and remained open, and that we were going to leave in a better state if we applied ourselves and remained open. It was a short speech, but I felt it was powerful.
Tell us about the exercises you did.
We were on the patio, and Ty had each one of us, one by one, sit on this folding chair in the middle of the space, surrounded by everyone else. And for several minutes, he'd just look at you, straight in the eye. When it happened to me, I felt so self-conscious. Everyone was watching me while I was trying to hold his stare, which was harder than you'd think. I was fighting not to look away because of how odd and intense it was. After a few minutes of this, he asked me why I was there. And I told him, I want to be happier. So he asked me why I was unhappy, and I was going to say my marriage was in trouble, but instead I said, I'm lonely. That felt more truthful in the moment. But Ty looked dissatisfied with that answer. He asked me what I wasn't sharing, and I said I didn't know. And then he dropped my gaze and asked the next person to sit down.
How did you feel?
Ashamed. Actually, like I failed some tests I didn't understand. Some people would give their answer and he'd smile or touch their shoulders or give them some verbal approval. Something I did was wrong.
What happened next?
We all laid down and Ty walked us through a series of guided meditations. It was hard for me to let go of my sense of guilt, so I found it difficult concentrating at first. But when he got to a chanting meditation, I was able to get out of my head. Chanting was always something I had an easier time with, and at one point during the chanting, when I was fully in the moment and my mind was blank, I felt this really warm hand touch my forehead, and I knew it was Ty. And it just felt really meaningful that he touched me at the exact time I was connecting to the meditation. It just felt like he could tell somehow.
What happened when the chanting was over?
When the chanting was over, I realized my hair was a little damp at the temples from tears I didn't know I was making. Meditation can be really powerful to escape from your thoughts for a while. I felt unburdened at the end of that session, and the fact that I had some anxiety going into the session and then felt unburdened at the end reinforced the idea to me that this practice was healthy and beautiful.
And then?
And then we went to bed. I followed Sherry, who seemed to know what she was doing, all the way up to her bed. Ty smiled and touched her arm as we went past, and it made an impression on me that Sherry was someone who had the approval of this brilliant guy. So we went to bed, didn't even put on pajamas, didn't brush our teeth, just followed upstairs in this blissful state of relaxation and drifted off. I woke up with my leg draped across Sherry, but it didn't feel invasive or anything. We were all already deeply comfortable with one another.
What was the second day like?
It was a lot of work. We were up with the sun after only a few hours of sleep. I was on breakfast duty that day, and I scrambled about 6 dozen eggs. There was no coffee, and I remember getting a caffeine headache. We did some movement work on the beach, which is sort of like yoga or Tai Chi. We'd move our bodies very slowly into poses, and Tai would announce the intention we should have with each one. The focus that day was letting go. Tai walked around and placed a hand on our lower back or neck or outstretched forearm, whatever needed to be corrected. After movement work, we went inside and sat around the common space. It was so crowded, we were all touching one another in some way. That's the first time I heard Ty sermonize. We called it a lecture that day, though. He spoke to us for hours.
What did he speak about?
He talked about the importance of meditation and how it was the tool mankind needed to heal itself and unlock its potential.
Potential for what?
Name it. He said everyone in that room was only using 10% of their brains, which is a statistic I heard before, and that through meditation, the other 90% can be unlocked. Not yoga studio meditation or app meditation, but real meta under a leader. He said we try to fix ourselves and our communities by focusing outward on our actions.
What does that mean?
For example, if we're overweight, we diet or exercise. If we're unemployed, we draft resumes. If we disagree with a law, we file petitions, but none of these things have a permanent effect. He compared it to having an infection. He told us to imagine some trauma that happened to our bodies. We were cut or stabbed, or our skin was open in some way, and that the site of the injury got infected. And instead of taking antibiotics, we just managed the symptoms. We took anti-inflammatories and pain pills. We wiped the sweat from our foreheads when we caught fever. We inhaled steam when our respiratory systems failed. All these things might help us feel better, but the infection still spreads. And we'll manage our symptoms all the way until we die. He told us we all had traumas, bad things that happened to us, from small things like getting snapped at by your mother to big things like having a loved one die. We're riddled with traumas that we incur in daily life, and we never actually heal them. We just have a beer or repressed, or worst of all, unleash our pain outward and traumatize another. We're managing the symptoms of the traumas we incur, but we're not actually healing ourselves. The only way to total healing was through going inward, addressing the problem inwardly, giving your mind the time and space it needs to heal itself. And meditation was the way to do that. And he, Tai, had studied and practiced contemplative science meditation for over 20 years and understood how it needed to be done.
What is contemplative science?
That's the name of Tai's own practice, the one he invented.
I thought you were practicing metta.
I did at the circles in Gainesville, but once I started going to the retreats, we only did contemplative science.
Okay. And was this information resonating with you?
Yeah. I mean, not everything, not at first. The healing stuff I understood, but he also talked about using more than 10% of his brain. When he started saying that he'd unlocked more brain potential than anyone else through these practices, a red flag started going off for me.
What exactly was that claim?
That was the point. It was unclear. He kept repeating himself over and over that through these practices, potential would be unlocked. And if we all of us, mankind, joined together in this practice, not only would we as individuals begin healing, but our communities would start healing. Then our countries would heal. Then war would stop. If we all looked inwardly toward healing, we could save ourselves. And a part of that was due to the understanding we'd unlock, unlocking that potential, unlocking more than that 10%. I guess the theory was that if we healed our minds, then our minds are free to keep growing, because it's the traumas that stunt our growth. It's the constant symptom managing that prevents us from progressing beyond our 10%. But when we're healed, growth begins again, progress begins again. And if we as a world are healed and our minds are expanded and our understanding deepened, there's no need for war or conflict. Mankind would be saved. And Tai claimed he'd unlocked 29% of his own brain power.
Exactly 29?
That's what he said. One guy piped up with a question about how Tai knew it was 29%. Like, how was that measured? And the whole room turned at him, like, how rude for interrupting, like he was disrespectful.
How did Tai react?
He seemed more gentle than the rest of the room. He said there were methods for measuring potential, and he looked forward to sharing those with us all in the future. He also said that he felt there were some people in the room putting up barriers, and it was inhibiting the rest of us from being fully open. So we were reminded to focus on openness, and we could do a mantra silently if we were feeling overwhelmed.
There are many red flags from Lola's account of her first retreat, but none surprise me. These are universal patterns. It's very common in destructive cults to pair a new recruit up with a more senior member. Sleep deprivation, constant activity, yes. And seminars are a common aspect of cult indoctrination. Group leaders intentionally induce trances in their followers by the repetition of phrases, using a droning tone, speaking for hours at a time, again, to sleep-deprived people. What happens is that a mild trance is induced in a follower, and they continue hearing and absorbing material from the speaker while they're in a highly suggestible state. The 1-2 punch of meditations plus sermonizing to a new recruit is very effective.
Not every psychiatric expert agreed with Stella Laughlin's assessments of hypnotic states.
A trance is a specific hypnotic state. It can't be achieved so easily or regularly as that. Many people visit trained and highly skilled hypnotists without ever being able to enter a trance. And those are people that are trying. The idea that an untrained speaker could hypnotize an entire room with the tone of his voice or the use of repetitive phrases is absurd. It's a very romantic concept, but it's just unrealistic.
Temple Representative Michael Learn also weighed in. His voice would become familiar not only with jurors, but with spectators at home. He appeared on talk shows and in news outlets, addressing criticism of his temple that was brought on by the Adams trial.
While I take some issue with some of the characterizations asserted by Ms. Adams, the nuts and bolts of what she described from the Keys sermons were accurate. It is our belief that through focused meditation, we can heal past traumas. I don't think that's an uncommon philosophy.
You're speaking about emotional traumas.
All trauma. Healing has to occur within ourselves and within our minds first. This is a peaceful practice.
Are you suggesting even physical ailments can be cured through meditation?
Yes, I am. It's very difficult. And I can't say I'm an expert, but the mind-body connection is more powerful than any of us realize. Consider the placebo effect for scientific proof of this. We can heal ourselves with our minds if our minds are free enough to do the work.
Do you believe that Ty Byman uses a greater percentage of his brain capacity than most people?
Yes, but I believe anyone who applies these meditation techniques consistently will be able to tap into a greater brain capacity.
Do you believe these meditative practices are harmful?
Absolutely not. Ours is a peaceful practice.
How do you address the accusation that your group kept new recruits intentionally sleep-deprived or that you deprived them of privacy?
Everyone was paying to be there. They were there to learn as much as they could. Accusing TCS of spending too much time teaching them is unfair. Doesn't every student want as much instruction as possible? As for the privacy complaint, that's also unfair. For $400, you are not going to get a private room at the beach in Key Largo. You have to bunk with fellow participants. Maybe if we charged everyone $10,000, we could arrange for a more comfortable experience, but let me also say that to materially indulge participants defeats the purpose of this work. If we offered Egyptian cotton and room service to every person interested in contemplative science, how much would they absorb? This was a meditation retreat. Lola was lucky to be there.
Objection. Your Honor, this witness is making claims without foundation, and we'd like to request...
The ambiguous nature of influence is what makes stories like these so difficult to debate. When does persuasion become coercion?
I got to ask you guys a question. How many of you are using more than 10% of your brains right now? This room is driving
how would you
me
even
crazy.
Know Jesus Christ, I hope I'm using more than
10%. I wish I had 29% of my brain to use.
I've got 31, but I only use 29.
But then you're talking about perspective. It depends how big your brain is to
listen,
start.
Listen, whatever that guy is saying, whatever my perspective is, I mean, it's a crock.
It sounds like every other new age trend that's coming up nowadays, like yoga retreats, vegetarian, meat eating, veganism.
No, you see, this is
some
the problem.
Of which are
Christianity,
and
Judaism. Islam, everything.
Well, this
it
guy.
Sounds like
no.
every type
no,
of
no, 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 no,
every
see, that,
type
well,
of
that, no. That's the problem. Oh. You see, like I said previously to you all, I've done meditation. It's helped me. But what this guy does,
about what the 10% versus 29%. He gives this stuff a bad name.
Well, honestly, it's what they refer to as a destructive cult, and the process that they're going through sounds so similar to what a lot of friends have gone to through, whether it was EST years ago or some New Age program or whatever. There's always some guru, somebody who you revere, and this Thai is kind of a low-level guru. I mean, who's ever heard of him?
A low-level philosophy.
Yeah.
I mean, he just kind of sounds like your cliché cult leader.
Exactly.
It's not
exactly.
Even his real name.
That's true. Well,
this sounds so common to me, is what it sounds like. It sounds so.
I denigrate him because he changed his name, but right. You know,
like any other type of cult leader. What do you think,
exactly.
Alex? You seem irritated.
You know, this is what I'm thinking. I am
not
irritated.
A very successful
I'm irritated. Look, as we previously discussed, when Mark was on the stand before, I thought that he was kind of flippant, but he didn't creep me out. Some of the things that he said was kind of creepy, right. But he didn't bother me per se.
Yeah, that's what
but
you
I kind of noticed that, like, Mark and when Michael was on the stand, something about their tone and the way that they spoke, they kind of talked in the same way. Did you guys notice that?
Pretty calm and kind of
almost rehearsed.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it is rehearsed.
It is rehearsed.
100%. Yeah, it's a program.
It
it's a program they're following.
They might as well have a script written
for them. The Thai has created,
you agree with that, too, then?
Yeah. And I actually really believe, I also agree with what you were saying earlier about the whole meditation thing. I mean, this guy's giving meditation a bad name.
Yeah.
I myself, not to get too personal, but I mean, I've gone through a lot of...
You seem like a personal person, Shane.
Whatever. I've gone through some, a couple of things here and there, and I've had my fair share of therapy, and it's been helpful. I mean, just like Alex says, meditation is a really powerful thing, and I've gone through a lot of psychotherapy, and I don't want to discredit what psychotherapy and meditation can do, because it's really helped me, and it's helped a lot of my friends with depression, but he's spinning it and giving it all these crazy terms and saying he has 29% of his brain because he's done psychotherapy and he's done all of this. And it's just turning it into all this hogwash. And I'm like, well, now we are discrediting meditation. And so I think in this conversation that we have, I think we should separate ourselves from things that are actually useful, like psychotherapy and meditation, and not discredit that they're not real. But I think we should discredit Thai because...
Oh, definitely.
I mean,
yeah.
The whole 29% of my brain thing really stood with me, and I thought that was so funny.
Okay, but I think the actual trauma guidance sounded really compelling. Like,
I didn't hear the first part of what you said.
I said that I think the trauma guidance sounded really compelling, the idea of actively kind of challenging past grievances and things to kind of come through it. Like you said, with the meditation, that kind of teaching, that bit of it really does appeal to me almost.
But he's a rehearsed person. This is his TV spiel that he gives.
Yeah, because on the flip side of that, I actually found when she was talking about how the practice that she went through when she felt that she failed him and she felt guilty and she felt ashamed when she felt she'd said the wrong thing by saying she was lonely in the practice, she was waiting for him to almost give her approval. Mm-hmm. And so that when he then... touched her on the forehead when she was meditating and she felt like she had that breakthrough. To me, that reminded me again of kind of like an abusive relationship, She was waiting for his approval and then that changed 100%. Her entire outlook.
Do you think that he was purposely trying to change her identity?
Yes.
Freezing and unfreezing and all that, stuff.
Okay.
So you think this? Let me ask. So you guys think this was a part of a program that they meant to do this?
Oh, absolutely. It's a business.
Yeah.
Yes. And this is their program to get your money.
Campbell, it seems like you've never rehearsed anything before.
Why do you say that?
Why would you say that?
I didn't say that. I said, it seems like you've never rehearsed anything before.
Francis, start making sense, please.
Yeah,
I don't know what that has to do with anything.
Well, because when you spoke earlier about how, but everything he was saying sounds so rehearsed, it seems like you've never rehearsed anything you believe in.
That's not true. I've given lectures on nursing.
Exactly.
She rehearsed for like 7 years of her life to do
her
career.
40 years.
Exactly. Right.
40 years.
I meant of college
nursing.
And stuff.
Once again, Francis, where are you going with this?
Yeah, where I'm going with this is that he sounds rehearsed because he's been doing this for so long, just like you've been nursing.
And but been, he's been she's saying it lacks an, like an element of intimacy and authenticity.
So he's been on. How many times has he been on witnesses at a murder trial? Yeah. You're not.
Yeah, that's a fair point. How many times has he been on a witness trial?
Probably never.
Van, what are your thoughts?
I'm going to use the knife analogy that I learned a long time ago. You can give a knife to a surgeon, she or he will save a life. You can give a knife to a killer, she or he will take a life. It is not the knife. Now, again, I use 29% of my brain. And then when he's challenged on that to give factual evidence, oh, well, I'll cover that later. All the vagueness about this. Mm-hmm. Now, I challenge Lola to use her discernment. Again, I'm going to use that word a lot. I challenge her discernment when she said it was a red flag. Why did she not exit?
I agree with that. It's the first red flag she's had the entire time.
So I mean, no. That was the first red flag.
Yeah. That she's had. Yeah.
Right. So that was the first one. When I hear that, I think, oh, so there were others.
There were exactly.
And she stayed by choice.
But you can't say you've never joined something and never had a red flag. That's all a part of our natural intuition.
I know. Have you ever dated?
And here's what I'll say about that. I can say that. And when I see that red flag, I'm out of here.
All right. Well,
as much as I like,
Lola listen. Was weak, and she was looking for something, and she was escaping her life.
We've all been.
That doesn't excuse her. In testimony.
Yeah, that Lola doesn't excuse her.
I know she did, and escape. I heard it.
Yeah.
But
meditation was a way to escape what was going on in her mind.
Right.
Yeah, we all meditate.
Right.
It's not a negative thing. It's
but
not a
it's
drug.
It's not for escape. And trance.
It's for clarity and escape. Yes.
Trance does not equal hypnosis. Okay, meditation
I
does not equal trance.
Yeah, Dr. Kirk.
I think that all the science we've heard has actually said that meditation is basically a state of trance.
No, that is not true. Dr. Kirk specifically said that somebody that's untrained in this is not somebody that can, you know, put everybody into a room and hypnotize them. This is where I was talking about previously.
No, this is about being in the state of trance.
We've got to remember as well, he's depriving them of sleep.
And when they're meditating,
intimacy,
and
so it's more
sleep, they're in more suggestive states.
That's true.
She was not deprived of sleep. She had a nice sleep. She had her leg draped around Sherry. Yeah, she heard that from Lola herself.
One at
she
a
said
time.
She woke I mean, up this and it was borderline uncomfortable, but she was like, you know what? It's fine. I'm going to roll with it. It's happening.
I got a wife. I got two kids. I'm borderline uncomfortable every single night, but I still get some good sleep. That doesn't mean that I'm sleep
deprived. It's your own bed.
Now, listen, that the retreat was not my thing, but I don't think it was a horrible, weird...
No. I think the retreat...
She had a good time.
The retreat had a...
Yeah,
no, the
it
retreat...
It was a good escape.
I think so, too.
It was a lovely weekend.
No, they had an agenda from the moment she walked in there.
Oh, that's
true. Yes, they did. They did, yes.
But she was... Not
Campbell,
totally
you
aware.
Gotta decide here. You're so flip flop with this whole thing. It's like you tell me that.
I am.
I know, but it's like you say, it's a retreat. It's all fun, but it has an agenda.
No, I'm saying
Where
that
are
for
retreat
Lola,
has an agenda.
It
You've
was
never been
fun.
On a work retreat.
It was enjoyable. It was enjoyable. It was escape. It was pleasurable.
She was treated like
it was
a
pleasurable,
queen.
But then they had an agenda.
Of course, they had an agenda.
All right, so listen, Banks. You're. I'm not really getting a real sense of where you're at right here. What did this make you feel? Look, I know from the beginning you felt that, you know, she's not guilty. What was it about this entire discussion from Lola to Dr. Kirk to Stella? Has this influenced you in any way, shape, or form?
I still feel that I really empathize with how she became involved in all of this, because when they were talking about the course and the idea, I mean, he freaks me out. He is definitely a manipulator.
Ty.
Yes, sorry, Ty.
No problem.
Ty is a manipulator, and the idea of the temple, that creeps me out. But the idea of this course and the idea of going to heal trauma, that kind of does appeal. And again, I feel that I would be that susceptible person that could fall into this and as it goes along. And when we were talking about red flags, we've all been on those dates where the person you're talking to makes a bad joke or spits a little bit of food on your face and you think,
that
oh, God.
That is absolutely right.
But, you know, you kind of roll with it and you think, okay, maybe he's not what I thought, but let's just give it another go.
Let me point out something to you. I think a lot of people in the past maybe rolled with that, and that's why we have some of the fantastic movements that we have today that are going to empower my daughter when she's growing up. If there's any red flags when you're on a date, run. just like Lola should have run.
So it turns into that
hindsight.
Irrational.
It's always the hindsight.
We always say should have. We can't look at hindsight.
And let me point something out there. Like, yes, a lot of some of these destructive cults have done some terrible things that we know about in the news. Like, I consider white supremacists cults. I consider ISIS cults, and they've killed a lot of people. But you don't hear about murders of husbands all the time.
Exactly.
And
a cult of murderers of husbands?
Well,
I think about the Manson family.
Well, yeah, that was certainly a cult, and they're all in jail.
Jonestown, wow. Mass suicide / murder, you know, depending on what kind of side of the fence you sit
on. And even TCS has worldwide members. Certainly other members have left the cult before. Nobody has ever been murdered.
I'd like to pose a question.
Yeah.
In the state of Florida, if someone kills a doctor who commits abortion, are they exonerated because of their beliefs?
The answer is no.
I rest my case.
That's a pretty different situation, but okay.
I don't think that's different.
Well, belief.
You're talking about a doctor doing a medical procedure.
Yeah.
And then someone killing him because they didn't agree with that. That's not having anything to do with the way that they've been programmed and manipulated.
That's how religions work.
Actually,
the doctor was programmed. I'm saying the murderer was programmed by their belief system because of their religion.
That's true.
So I haven't met a religion that tells people to kill people if they abort babies.
There are plenty of hardcore Christian movements that actually do propagate that. They actually do tell people that.
Well, then I believe that's awful. Just as much as I believe it's awful that TCS is telling people to kill.
Does not make that true or not true.
Get arrested.
They never told anybody to kill.
They told her that if anybody left it, that there would be serious damage done to humanity.
But do we know that?
Vague and nebulous.
Listen, I'm going to play the jury foreman card right here. I don't get a sense from Van what you think about that retreat. Do you think that was a part of this brainwashing program to manipulate these people to become killers later?
I think a small part of it was.
It
not
could have
it.
Been.
No, not to make
There's
people
no proof
be killers. It was the first step in indoctrinating people into coming into the
cult.
Group, into the cult.
Yes, right.
That led to giving away all of your personal goods, to becoming a different person, to become an evangelist of the cult, get other people into it, and to turn over all of your
money. But did you hear anything at this retreat, any testimony about at this specific retreat where they talked about if people out there don't do this, if people out there
absolutely
leave this cult or don't meditate, then the world is going to die?
Yeah, but
I didn't hear any
evidence.
That comes later.
I understand, but I'm talking about this very first, about this retreat from the beginning.
It sounds like we all agree it's manipulation.
So it sounds like a process. It's part of a setup. It's part of the program.
But can we all agree that we agree that there was some manipulation that went on at this camp?
Of course.
All right, we finally can agree on something.
Yes.
It's a standard program.
This was a platform for time. To put himself up there as the leader, as the god.
Sure.
He, you know, the guy that questioned, how do you measure 29% of brain power?
That
guy
that
was
still
then
gets to me.
Well, and
but then that guy was then put down and kind of said again so that he could control the language used, which again is another.
I'll agree that there was a program. I'll agree that there was agenda. I just, if she was in a hurtful place and she was vulnerable and this helped her heal a little bit, is that necessarily harmful? Was the retreat harmful?
No, I don't think some of the things they did were harmful because I agree with psychotherapy and I agree with meditation, but I just don't agree with the message that they're pitching after it.
Okay. Yes. All right. Okay. Okay.
Because we know the bigger picture. We know this was a tool in the greater scheme of mind control manipulation.
So this was just a step.
Yes.
It sounds like we just put out World War II. We all agreed on the first thing.
Yeah.
how did you, when the TCS witnesses were on the stand, I know I keep overly focusing on this because I just seem to be obsessed with this idea of identity and this kind of people taking on this TCS identity.
Are you talking about the real identity versus the cult identity?
Yeah. How did you guys get a sense of them being, you know, like kind of one almost like the Borg, right? You guys like Star Trek, Next Generation, the Borg. Once you get into it, you become a part of the Borg.
Of course, they're all.
I was a Star Wars guy, man.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, but did you feel that when they were on the stand too? Because I did.
Yes. Absolutely.
It was robotic to me.
Yeah, I was about to say robots of the cult. Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
I can tell you from taking part in training programs for litigation attorneys that there is a direct examination, a cross-examination, and the attorney on your side will prep you to speak in a manner that will support your side of the story.
So okay. Manipulate you to, or no, at least train you?
They will train you.
Or coerce.
They will train you.
Because they have an agenda too.
They will train you to speak in a manner that will make their side of the court case more favorable.
Exactly.
And why would they want to make them look robotic?
No.
TCS wants
that.
To win, just like anyone else.
I didn't say they were robotic. I'm saying that the attorney who does the direct exam will prepare the witness to speak in a manner that will support their side.
But we're saying that manner is unfavorable, so why would they promote
I'm not saying it's
I want to bring up a point.
I'm saying this is what happens.
Francis brought up a really good point. As much as this trial, and I don't want to divulge away from this, okay? I don't want to divert our attention too much. But we got to focus in on this, and this is important. As much of this trial is to figure out whether or not Lola's self-defense and belief was reasonable, this trial really is about TCS being on trial and whether or not they, you know, whether or not they should be found some kind of guilt. And they're trying to protect themselves as much as humanly possible as well.
Yeah. Just like anybody who wants to win. Mm-hmm.
Correct. I mean, they're an organization.
You're going to do whatever it takes in order to win if you believe it.
And they were prepared.
Yeah, again, they're sacrificing one more person.
So let me ask you a question, Alex, since you brought up to my attention. Let me just say, like, let's go back to red flags here. What if, you know, I asked you to murder somebody? Hang on, just roll with me here.
Do you want me to answer or respond?
Is he murdering
you? What would happen if I asked you to murder someone?
Depends on who the someone was. If it was Adolf Hitler, I would kill him.
Okay. Okay, that's fine. Have you been raised that murder is a good thing or a bad thing?
I mean, I grew up in the Catholic Church, and so we were trained that thou shalt not kill. With an asterisk, there are certain people that should have been killed.
Sure. Yeah, of course. Right? We're talking in absolutes here. But let me – what if genuinely, honestly thought that Shane was going to kill you, your family, your mom, your dad – your dog, whatever, what would you say then?
It would depend upon whether or not Shane actually had the power to do that. If he had a gun or if he had some kind of a car or if he had a bomb, then that would be a reasonable belief. If I just sat here and believed it and you know, Shane's just sitting there writing a screenplay, I mean, come on.
I agree with that.
Okay, well.
So we should start looking from Lola's perspective in order to truly understand it. That way we can come to a consensus of everything combined.
That's why I'm saying we got to figure out whether or not her belief was reasonable.
Reasonable.
Right.
Reasonable.
Keyword.
Right.
Fair enough.
Looking through Lola's perspective could take us into a dark and labyrinthine place. Next time on Deliberations.
I need your help. I need it more than ever.
She was a goddamn different person.
She was herself.
Deliberations is created, written, produced, directed, and edited by me, Chelsea Cox, and it proudly airs as part of the Audio Boom Network. Today's cast: Jury, Rudy Sallow, Sherry Michaels, Kate Mullen Wallace, J.P. Stanley, Mark Smeltzer, and Jim Donnelly. Courtroom: Katarina Tana, Michael Neal, Cooper Hardin, John Andrews, Eric Schein, Ann Gundry, and Cindy Lopez. On our next jury break, we are speaking with Michael Bluejay, raised in a philosophical cult called Aesthetic Realism, about the great myths of cult recruitment. See you then.